This is a production of Cornell University.
I want to welcome you to the opening of the Human Rights Campaign Collection and the simultaneous online exhibition. I'm in my eighth day of being the interim university librarian, but I've come prepared. I've watched Sarah Thomas over the years at these openings, and I'm always impressed by what she has to say, but equally impressed by the fact that she always manages to coordinate her outfit with the wonderful posters that Ken puts together. So I've done my bit for that today. Today is a first in the Division of Rare and Manuscript Collections to hold two major openings on the same day. When I first learned of this, I thought, Brenda, what were you thinking? But my second thought was how appropriate it is to launch both of these together. I'll speak about the collection in a minute, but I'd just like to say how impressed I am with the online exhibition. It truly was unveiled today. I had to use the power of my office to get a sneak preview of it several days ago. But from what I've seen, I suspect we're looking at another award-winning exhibition from the Division of Rare and Manuscript Collections, which has just learned unofficially that they've won. You're pointing at, yes, I know. Just won these for the second year in a row, the first place in the exhibition award for online exhibits by the Rare Books and Manuscripts section of the Association of College and Research Libraries. For the online version of Vanished Worlds, Enduring People, Cornell's Native American Collection. That Cornell, yes, oh yes, clap for that. That Cornell was chosen over the Library of Congress to be the permanent home of this extraordinarily rich collection is due in large part to four things. First is the commitment of the library to establish and build the Human Sexuality Collection, beginning in 1988 with the donation of materials from the Mariposa Foundation. Second is the commitment of the faculty to teaching and research in this area and their support for the acquisition and use of this collection, which continues to this very day. I'd especially like to acknowledge the co-sponsorship of the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies Program, as well as the Lesbian, Bisexual, and Gay Studies Program for their support. Third is the commitment of the Office of the Provost, another co-sponsor, and specifically Biddy Martin, who lent not only top administrative support to secure the collection, but also funding to the tune of $50,000 to make the records accessible. With her support, we were able to hire additional staff to process this large, complex collection quickly and to create the accompanying exhibit. And fourth is the dogged commitment of Brenda Marston, the curator of the Human Sexuality Collection since 1989. Today represents the culmination of her work that began 12 years ago when she first contacted HRC about their collection. While Brenda stayed in touch with staff over the years, it took seven more years for HRC to decide to find a permanent home for its collection, a decision that was precipitated by their move to new headquarters. I was reviewing some of the correspondence surrounding the acquisition and came upon Brenda's single-spaced, three-page typed letter to Kim Mills, the education director, in January of 2003. Brenda details in this why Cornell is the best place for the collection. She cites the complementary holdings of the Human Sexuality Collection, the outreach and teaching efforts going on here, the support of senior scholars doing research in the collection, the Zwickler Memorial Symposium on Sexuality and the Archives entitled Sex in the Stacks. Actually, I was glad to read this because it cleared up a misconception I've had about the library's inclusion in the students' list of top 20 things to do before leaving Cornell. Who knew that Sex in the Stacks was referring to the experience of conducting research in the Human Sexuality Collection? A great bunch of students we've got here. Brenda summed up why Cornell was the best place for the HRC collection when she wrote, quote, "Our programs would not only preserve your records, they will make sure you stay a part of history. And today's events represent the first installment on that promissory note." So before turning this over to Biddy, to introduce our speaker, I'd just like to acknowledge a couple of other folks. Rhea Guerin, Daniel Miracle, and James Reedy for the quality of the images and streaming video. Ken Williams for the design of the website. Suzette Newberry for exhibits preparation. And Peter Martinez for the encoding of the finding aid, which I understand he did on his own time at home. To Amy Villarejo, director, and Hope Mandeville, program manager of the Feminist Gender and Sexuality Studies. To Rima Turner, a Cornell junior who worked in the collection for 2 years. To Matthew Kelly, a student from Bard College who spent his summer vacation interning here. And to all the others who make this library the finest place to work and to do work in. So thank you very much. Biddy?
Thank you, Anne. Hi, everybody. Well, of all the introductions I'm asked to make as provost, I have to say for me personally, this is one of the more exciting. I couldn't be happier to be here. I'm really happy so many of you could come out. And no one laughed. See, that was supposed to... Okay, that's the last joke I'm going to try. I thought it wasn't bad. Yeah, right. Okay, it worked better in a faculty meeting once when I said it. Well, I'm here actually just to express on behalf of all of you our extreme delight that Cornell will be the home of the Human Rights Campaign's collection. It's a unique opportunity. We certainly owe a huge amount to Brenda Marston and to the university library staff as a whole for securing this collection and adding it to the Human Sexuality Collection as a whole. It joins a number of other really important collections that are part of the Human Sexuality Collection, including the records of the National Lesbian and Gay Task Force and several other important organizations. And in this larger context, it will be possible for students and researchers to think about the politics of gay rights and advocacy for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender rights over a very long period of time, and that will be possible forever. Brenda worked very hard on the building of this collection and the securing of these particular records, but I just want to, since I'm getting pretty old now, I want to recall on her behalf and also on behalf of the rest of us that it wasn't at all easy to get the Human Sexuality Collection started some 20 years ago. There was quite a bit of resistance on this campus to the securing of the Mariposa Collection and to the formation of a Human Sexuality Collection, and a lot of struggle over what to call the collection. And I would say openly to those of you who weren't here, then a lot of anxiety about having it too heavily focused on gay, lesbian, and bisexual rights issues. At the time, transgender was not a term of art. Well, we did manage to get it, and it's going to be a great thing, not only for Cornell and for researchers and students at Cornell and across the world, but also for the struggle for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender rights going forward. And during a week in which Michigan's public institutions have lost the legal right to give same-sex benefits, and in the same week, of course, Snickers lost the right to show its ad featuring two kissing men, which was unveiled at the Super Bowl. I don't know how many of you saw that, but I thought it was one of the best moments of the Super Bowl. It was not raining in the ad, and just seemed like a great thing to me. In any case, during such a week, of which there are many weeks, and I fear will be many more weeks, it's especially heartening to have the head of the Human Rights Campaign, Joe Solmanes, with us, and to have staff members, in addition to Joe, who've come to campus, and even greater, to be able to say that this collection is now open to the public here at Cornell University. Before we hear from our speaker, Joe Solmanes, I want to acknowledge a few other people, and I'll be repeating a couple of thank yous that Anne already extended. In addition to Brenda Marston, whom I couldn't thank enough, not only for this collection, but for all she's done in general, I also want to repeat the names of two students who've done so much to make this possible. Rima Turner, who's a junior in anthropology. You're Rima, are you not? And I was told by someone that you are taking 20 credits yet again this semester in the College of Arts and Sciences, despite advice to the contrary. And you're doing that because there's so many exciting courses that you want to get under your belt. Well, that's amazing, and I wish you well. No. And Matthew Kelly, who's an intern from Bard. Is Matthew here? No, he couldn't be here. So. Oh, too bad. We're truly grateful to the Human Rights Campaign for these records and for this collection. I want to thank all of you for your help, especially Jackie Bennett, administration director, who shepherded this through, and Kim Mathis, who's come all this way to be with us. And most of all, of course, to thank Joe Solmanese, who's here to share his perspectives with us. And as many of you know, he became president of the Human Rights Campaign in the spring of 2005, after having served as chief executive officer of Emily's List, which oversaw or oversees still one of the nation's most successful efforts to elect progressive candidates, perhaps one could say in particular pro-choice candidates. He had great success in that position. And in his first 6 months as head of the Human Rights Campaign, he's done a number of things that are worth noting, important to note. I was just laughing with him and telling him that everything I've read about him online and in the materials that I was sent emphasize that he did in his first 6 months as president, traveled to 22 states, 35 cities, and logged 115,000 miles. Now, there's a very important political reason why that's the case, which is that he has a very firm commitment to taking the struggle out of Washington and out of the lobbying of the legislative branch and to the people of the United States and all of its various sectors, so it's explainable. I just thought it was amusing to see it emphasized in everything that's written about you. So you perhaps have the most frequent flyer miles of any advocate for these human rights that we know. He launched the Human Rights Campaign's brand new Religion and Faith program, which provides resources to LGBT and straight supportive people of faith, but also combats those who use religion as a weapon against those rights. And how could it be a more important time in the nation's history to think about the place of religion and also to combat its use as ideology in opposition to rights? This past fall, he led a strategic political and lobbying effort that resulted in the historic passage of gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender inclusive hate crimes legislation in the House of Representatives, and it was the first time that gender identity had been included in such hate crimes legislation. He oversees the work of the HRC's Marriage Project, which provides critical assistance and support to state and local groups and activists working on marriage equality. He's a frequent speaker, as you know, since I just told you he's logged 115,000 miles in his first 6 months. And he really meets with the public at every conceivable level and is committed to doing that and to changing people's views and to changing the fact of discrimination against gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgendered people. I don't know how we could be more appreciative or show greater appreciation. I don't know. What could I say? How shall I say this articulately? Well, I suppose just thank you. And we couldn't appreciate more what you're doing and what the Human Rights Campaign has done for us for decades. Thank you. Now, Joe Solmanese.
Thank you all very much. I have to say, Biddy, I didn't laugh at your joke because having just arrived here, I thought you were actually thanking people for coming outdoors. Because when I walked down the hill from the parking lot, I turned to Kim and I said, I feel like someone's throwing ice cubes at my forehead. I didn't know if that was a little sort of a welcoming thing that you all do for your visiting guests. But thank you, Biddy, for having me and for that warm introduction. I also want to introduce Kim Mathis, who is with me from HRC, and Jackie Bennett, who really is the architect from the HRC side on this project and has been, if you've ever been to Washington and been to the HRC building, she has been working on this project for quite some time, and she has really been the keeper of the archives at HRC, but also kind of runs the building and makes sure that it doesn't just run, but that it's always a welcoming place for members of our community who walk in the door almost every day to be part of that experience and to see the headquarters, and it's really a wonderful place. And Amy, who helped put this all together, and I know did so much work to get me here, and Brenda Marston, who I know is the force behind this project and who I'm thrilled to see again, was down in Washington and has been before working with us on this. You know, it's an interesting thing. I was thinking about this, about our history, about our movement's history. And initially I thought, you know, nothing is more important than this partnership with Cornell and HRC, because the repository of all of our history in one place is challenging, I think, for two reasons. One is obvious, and it is because sometimes in our movement, we don't think of the history because we're so in it. It's not old enough, and it is not far enough behind us that we sometimes think of it as history because we're sort of making it. And that's the obvious thing, and that's the important reason why this partnership is so valuable to our community and to the preservation of our history. But the other interesting thing about our movement's history that is not so true for other historic efforts that you might take a look at is that there are so many people out there who have worked to keep our history from being told and keep our story from being told. And whether that is curriculum in the classroom or whether that is publishing literature or telling our stories through any other sort of medium that would give people a sense of our history, we're in a unique position in that there is such a strong force out there in this country working to keep that from happening. And that's a unique thing when you think about it. And it's also why this partnership and Cornell's commitment to be that repository, to be that source of information, to chronicle not just HRC's history, but so many elements of the history, and to safeguard that and to have it as a vehicle for people who want to tell that history is so incredibly important, and why we're so grateful to Cornell for this partnership. I talked about our history being so so recent, and I don't know that everybody in this room even knows when some people think our history might have begun. How many people in this room are familiar with the Mattachine Society? Those of you sitting in the front, I'm not going to tell you how that broke out by age. So don't look back. But, you know, the Mattachine Society is a story that should be told, and that can be told because so much of it is here. The Mattachine Society was essentially the first gay rights organization. It was formed in the 1950s by a guy named Harry Hay from Los Angeles. It was actually founded in 1950, and it was founded at a time when not only was sodomy a crime in this country, but when homosexuality was still considered a mental illness, when it was illegal for gays and lesbians to congregate in one place and have a meeting, and when publishing anything GLBT related caused you to be violating any series of decency standards in this country. That was in 1950. There were some people who were alive in 1950 in this room. And that's, that's a story, that is something that we've always got to be reminding people, not just that that condition existed, but that that condition existed in this country. I mean, that condition exists right now in Nigeria. And so when we're looking globally and we're thinking about the world today, it's always important to remind people that that condition existed here in the lifetime of many people. And what I think is important is that that particularly be a story that we remind young people. Because oftentimes young people, either within the movement or not necessarily within the movement, but who are observing the world around us, are frustrated because they're impatient. And they're impatient about the progress of our movement. And so when we remind people, and the fact that this information and these stories are housed here is going to help to do that, that was a condition that existed in this country very recently. And the idea, when you read about the Mattachine Society and you read the minutes from their meetings and what it was like in the 1950s, and that their biggest challenge was finding a place to meet, it really puts a lot of our work in perspective. You know, I think about the work that we're doing to try to overturn Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I think about the kind of information that is chronicled again here that looks back at the military during previous times of war. I was reading something recently that we had sent up here about Eisenhower and about the fact that during World War II, he called one of the members of the WAC battalion, a woman, into his office, and he said that he thought they should make a list of all the lesbians serving. And she said that if she did that, she'd have to put her name at the top of the list. He then called his assistant in to talk to her about it, and she assumed that he was calling her in to tell her that he was going to put her name on the list too. And it changed Eisenhower's view of gays and lesbians serving in the military in the 1950s. And it's an interesting story, and one that I know we have been asked to provide some of our allies who are working to overturn that policy now. I think about the AIDS epidemic, probably the most significant time in the last 30 years or so of our movement. And I think about Bono, who is working to eradicate global AIDS right now, but who came to us to ask us questions about the GLBT community's response to AIDS in this country in the early 80s and what lessons he might take from that effort in his struggle. And that information is available because of the partnership we've made to safeguard these stories and to safeguard this information. And, you know, we talked to him to remind him of where we were just 25 years ago or 20 years ago or so. And I remember that we sent a story that I thought was a particularly dark one, but really illustrates where this country was just 20 years ago. It was the rededication of the Statue of Liberty. And at the rededication of the Statue of Liberty, this is such an 80s grouping, I think. It was President Francois Mitterrand and his wife, Ronald and Nancy Reagan, and Bob Hope. you saw a lot of that in the 80s, remember? And President Reagan, as many of you know, actually never said the word AIDS publicly. That was a challenge in and of itself. We got a pretty low bar when that's what we when that was our president's position on this. And at the rededication of the Statue of Liberty, Bob Hope decided that he was going to tell a joke, and the joke that he told was, "I just heard that the Statue of Liberty has AIDS, but she doesn't know if she got it from the mouth of Hudson or from the Staten Island Ferry." The mouth of Hudson being a joke on Rock Hudson, who had just recently announced that he had AIDS. You can imagine Bono's reaction to that story. But it's one of those stories. It's one of those illustrations of, I mean, you can't even imagine 20 years later someone saying something like that, let alone Bob Hope. But, you know, it's just a reminder of what the circumstances were like in the 80s when we began to take this fight on. And I think probably the greatest lesson that Bono learned and that we were able to impart by looking back at the stories of our struggle were that what we essentially did as a community during the 80s was take a look at what the government wasn't providing for us and create a virtual government to do that for us. You know, there should be no such thing as the gay men's health crisis in New York City. There should be no need for our community to build a healthcare center to service our community. But we did. And we did things like at the Human Rights Campaign, which was just being started, we went to the Hill and we began to talk about funding for HIV and AIDS. But the members of ACT UP laid their bodies across the Brooklyn Bridge and said, we will force the American people to pay attention to this epidemic this way. Both of those efforts were incredibly important in raising America's consciousness towards HIV and AIDS, and both of them are chronicled here and will continue to be incredibly useful to historians and others as we move forward in making sure that that story continues to be told and that we continue to learn from those sorts of experiences. So as we look forward, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the work of the Human Rights Campaign, and then I'm much more interested to hear from you and have a conversation with you about what's on your minds. I think that we can point to two things that really mark the turning point of a movement towards a better environment for GLBT people in this country. And so much of it, again, is based on looking at the lessons of the past. The first is the elections of last year. It really was a turning point for our country in terms of electing a record number of fair-minded people to Congress. And the things that we have been fighting for so long, like the passage of inclusive hate crimes legislation, the passage of inclusive workplace non-discrimination language, moving this country in the direction of marriage equality. At the federal level, maybe not necessarily moving immediately towards marriage, but closing some of those economic inequities that exist in this country in the absence of marriage. All of those things have been put into play as a result of the elections last November, and it is by no means a partisan victory as much as it is a victory for, as I said, a record number of fair-minded people. I will say, though, that the fact that the Democrats are in charge means that the people who control things are a lot more likely to be our friends, and it really was, I think, a historic day for me when I went up to the Hill last week and met with Steny Hoyer, who is the newly appointed majority leader in the House of Representatives, and he sat down at his desk with a piece of paper and basically said, what do you want and when do you want it? No one's ever said that to me in that capacity before. And as I get older, in not many other capacities. But it was a historic and big day for our community when someone that high up in leadership in Congress wants to talk to you about scheduling a legislative vote as opposed to learning about what it is that you do. That is a huge gain for our community. The other big gain for our community that's come in the last couple of years or so, and I'm glad that you brought up the Snickers example, because it's really come to my way of thinking in all of the places in this country where people congregate. And if you think about it, those working against us have got one built-in strategy for success that really works for them. It's less about the power of the scripture and the power of religion and more about the tactic of the congregation. I went last year to Coretta Scott King's funeral, and I was sitting in this cathedral in Atlanta, Georgia, and I was sitting next to Howard Dean, the chairman of the Democratic National Committee, and I said, how many people fit in this cathedral? And he said, 8,000. And I said, do you think they fill it every Sunday? And the woman in front of us turned around and she said, they fill it once at 9 and once at 11. And it illustrated to me, and the preacher whose church that was by no means a friend to the GLBT community, that he had a captive audience every Sunday morning of 16,000 people to talk about whatever he wanted to talk about. And that tactic of that captive audience is something that has eluded us in our community for far too long. So what we have essentially done at the Human Rights Campaign, you heard a little bit about our Religion and Faith Project, is look out across the country and say, how can we find places where people congregate on a daily basis and make change there? And I think that is where, that is the other element of our work and of the movement in our history where we have seen the most change. And if you think about it, target number one, the American workplace, communities of faith, colleges and universities, healthcare settings, where members of our community go on a daily or occasional basis and interact with Americans either by design or not. We began 4 years ago having a conversation about this with corporate America, about corporate America creating a more welcoming, equitable experience for their GLBT workforce. We began rating American corporations 4 years ago. 13 Fortune 500 companies scored a perfect 100% rating with us 4 years ago. This year, 150 Fortune 500 companies score a perfect 100% on our Corporate Equality Index. That's in 4 years. We've changed the experience for GLBT people in ways we never imagined. And the reason I'm glad you brought up the Snickers story is because every once in a while, as successful as we are in that work, we hit a little speed bump. And you may have seen or read about Microsoft a couple of years ago backing off of a non-discrimination measure in the state of Washington, Ford Motor Company getting a little antsy about advertising in GLBT publications. Every once in a while, we have a little setback. We were upset about Snickers, not the advertisement that was played during the Super Bowl, but the website that Snickers Corporation put up. Because on the website, what they were trying to get you to do was vote on one of four commercials. And the winner of the four commercials was then going to be some other big sporting event, which of course I know. I didn't even watch the Super Bowl. So, but like the Daytona, whatever the next big thing is that's coming, that 18 to 24-year-old men watch, that I know. And so you could pick, and commercial number four was called The Wrench, and it was the same image of the two men working under the hood of the car and eating the Snickers bar and accidentally kissing, backing up, being horrified, saying they had to do something manly. One starts to beat the other one with a wrench, and the other starts to slam his friend's head in the hood of the car. That's the one I had a problem with. You know, the pulling the body hair off, I had a little bit less of a problem with. And the other thing that I had a problem with was that they showed on this website NFL football players watching these ads and being completely repulsed by the ads. And I had a real problem with the imagery of football players who so many young men look up to being so repulsed by the sight of these ads. And so, you know, we made a little noise about it. I did the Paula Zahn show on Monday afternoon, and when I came back from doing the show, the public relations director of the M&M Corporation had called me to say all of the things had been pulled off the website. The advertisement was not going to be run in the Daytona 500 or any place else ever again, and they wanted to begin a conversation with us about also scoring 100% on our Corporate Equality Index. So that's the kind of change we're making in corporate America. And you take that same model and you move it to communities of faith. We're doing the same work there. Colleges and universities, and in particular, our HBCU program, which has a unique emphasis on historically black colleges and universities, working with students there. The newest effort that we've taken on, our Healthcare Equality Index, going into America's hospitals and trying to change the experience for our community there. You heard that I travel a lot. One of the first places I went to last year when I started was to Kansas, and I met two lesbian moms with two girls, little girls, and one of them said to me, you know, we do have all of our legal documentation in a binder by the front door in case anything happens to one of the girls. One night, the mom who is not the biological mother was home with the girls, and one of them fell down and split her head open. And she ran out the door, And she stopped at the door to pick up the binder with all the legal information. And she threw the kids in the car, and she went to the hospital. And as she walked through the front door of the emergency room, she stopped again, and she looked across at the admitting people. And she thought, which one of these people looks like they'll be most sensitive to our sort of unique family? And at that point, I thought to myself, no parent should ever have to do that. And we launched our healthcare equality index to do essentially the same thing that our corporate project does, except with America's hospitals, to sit down with America's hospitals and have a conversation about that parent walking through the door of the emergency room and how we could change that dynamic for members of our community so that they didn't have to feel that sort of challenge when they're walking in to have basic healthcare that anybody in this country has access to. What's fascinating about that strategy, about that work in these sorts of places that Americans congregate every day, is that I believe the people who are most changed in those settings are the straight people around us. I went to speak at Pennsylvania Power and Light Corporation up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania recently. And I went to speak to the GLBT work group there, and it was probably a room about this size with about the same number of people in it. And after I spoke, a man came up to me and, you know, he put his hand out and he said, I'm straight, which, you know, I know for some people is more important than telling me their name but when they meet me. So he said, I'm straight, but he said, the reason I'm here is because for 10 years or so that I've worked for this company, I've worked alongside this woman. And over the years, this company has gotten, you know, he said, sort of better and better for the gay people. And one year we did domestic partner benefits, and one year we wrote gender identity and sexual orientation into the non-discrimination plan, and one year they honored Pride Month, and we sponsored an AIDS walk. And each year that went by, as the company sent the message out over and over and over again that GLBT people are welcome, are safe, are valued, are important, that woman sitting next to me felt more and more encouraged to come out, because she worried less about what I thought of her, because she knew more about what the corporation thought of her, and she felt safe and powerful and open about coming out. So she came out to me as a result of the message she was getting from the corporation. And he said, I don't know, I didn't know how I felt about lesbians. I had a feeling I knew how he felt about lesbians. He said, but I know how I feel about her. And in her coming out, I was immediately conflicted and eventually had to come around. Now, I tell you that story because the reason that I think those changes all across America where people congregate every day are so valuable and so important in terms of our movement is because I think that sort of story happens every day in these settings all across the country. And that the work that we're doing as a movement to change the experience for our community is really changing everyone in that setting. And so people say to me, what's the most important thing that you can do to try and move our community towards full marriage equality? And I say, you know, there are a lot of things that we can do. We can elect legislative bodies that are going to do that. And we are slowly but surely doing that. Here in New York, we elected another pro-marriage candidate just yesterday or the day before. Connecticut, Vermont, California, working to elect pro-marriage legislatures. We can try and fight these ballot measures as we have, although largely unsuccessfully. And the third, and I think most important thing that we can do is try and change the mindset of the American people, not about marriage as the abstract concept, but about the circumstances of our lives and our relationships and the inequities that exist in them. And we're doing that in these settings in ways that I don't think anybody ever imagined. So, in all the work that we're doing moving forward, I see progress, I see change, I see it moving at rapid pace. But in order to keep everyone invested in that work, young people in particular, we need to always be able to go back and tell the stories of that work, remind people of what it was like and how very recently it was like that. And again, this partnership, Cornell University and the wonderful people here are doing their part and are going to be a valuable resource to HRC and to members of our community. I'm incredibly grateful for all that you've done, and I'm incredibly grateful to be with you here today. And I would love to take your questions. Unless, of course, I've answered them all. But. Well, great. Oh, yes.
As a Cornell undergraduate who is interested in politics and policy, what can I do beyond joining a Gay-Straight Alliance or some of our other GLBT groups to actually engage my peers and to try to rouse out some political action, maybe? Something Cornell students aren't always known for, and actually get people involved.
I think that the biggest challenge that we face in getting young people, you know, fill in the blank, involved, activated, inspired, is that we, more often than not, don't have a clear direction to send them in. We don't have something tangible enough to get people organized around. I spoke at Hobart and William Smith College, which must be somewhere near here. I took a similar plane from New York City to a similar place in New York, so I know it's near here. And I talked about Chuck Schumer. And I talked about Chuck Schumer's campaign, and the woman I was speaking to raised her hand and said, "Well, now who's Chuck Schumer?" I say that's probably as much Chuck Schumer's fault as Chuck Schumer is your senator, by the way. I say that's probably as much Chuck Schumer's fault as her fault. But you know, my experience, and as you heard, I worked at Emily's List for 13 years before coming to HRC, and we certainly did a lot of work with young people on college campuses, and we do, you know, tenfold as much work at HRC. But I think we always have to be organizing people towards something. And so whether that's a political campaign, whether that's a job, people need to organize around something, and ultimately they need to see it be successful. You know, one of the best things that we're doing with our HBCU program, and the reason I like to point out, we have a program that is specifically directed to historically black colleges and universities is because we were told by people like the president of the United Negro College Fund, Jeanetta Cole, who's the president of Bennett College for Women, that there was violence happening on these campuses that the college administration was not identifying as GLBT violence. There was an unwillingness to recognize student groups. There were all sorts of cultural challenges that needed to be addressed in a more significant way, and so we went out to do that. But even in organizing students, you know, you've got to organize around and towards something. And one of the best things that we've done on college campuses has been to organize young GLBT activists with alumni out in the field in jobs and sort of move them towards networking and jobs. But I think organizing towards political campaigns is the most important thing you can do. And, you know, here, is this where our Curry is the new congressman from here? Is that a yes? Not this campus. Okay, well, that's a really good example. That's an even better example then. Because here is a guy who just got elected to Congress, has, you know, 100% on his HRC questionnaire. We've talked to him a lot. He's very committed to our issues. He was elected in a very difficult district, probably in a Democratic tidal wave, where, you know, there's some question about whether or not he'd be able to hold on to that seat. But if we're going to pass hate crimes in the House, if we're going to pass a meaningful, inclusive non-discrimination bill in the House, both of which I think we'll do this year, we really need his vote. Now, we'll have his vote. The question is, how problematic will his vote be when he stands for re-election? And so the most important thing anybody can do in exchange for that vote, or to show appreciation for that vote, is to go work to get that guy reelected. And it's even more important if he doesn't represent this college campus, because I always think it's important to remind people that just because he doesn't represent you doesn't mean he's not in Washington working for or against you on any given day. We had lots of people out there around the country who didn't understand why we wanted them to help Bob Casey beat Rick Santorum, since that was a Pennsylvania Senate race. And I said, you know, Rick Santorum got up every single day and tried to figure out how to make the lives of GLBT people in Pittsburgh and Las Vegas and Dallas and Seattle lousy. And so we were our target. He needed to be his. He needed to be our target. Young people are more difficult, and here's why, because they're so important. I mean, in our work, if we're going out and we're trying to, you know, we're trying to get somebody elected to Congress, or we're trying to pass a ballot, you know, defeat a ballot measure, an anti-marriage ballot measure, we have a really clear idea. If you're 40 or older, we can pretty much figure you out. You know, if you're over 75, we're going to hope for snow, you know, and hope that you don't come out. But because, you know, I mean, it's a raw political calculation, and you have only so many days and so many dollars. So you sort of say over 75, no. You know, 40 to 65, women are more supportive than men. You know, there's a whole range. You can sort of go all the way down and try and pick demographics. And, you know, we do this all the time on a ballot measure or a political campaign, you name it. Young people, and really I'm talking about people even under 40, but under 29 in particular, you know, they don't even understand why you're asking a question about gay marriage. That, you know, it's beyond support. It's to the point of, like, they're befuddled. So while there's still, obviously, there's homophobia among young people, but, you know, you've got, like, in the 70s in terms of their support for marriage, even someone who self-identifies as a conservative. So there's this huge pool of support for, you know, any particular issue. But there are two problems. One, in the sort of the communications realm, it's very difficult to reach young people. And the other is that young people oftentimes either feel so empowered that, you know, the reason I say this is Chuck Schumer's fault as much as that young woman's fault is because, you know, Chuck Schumer is of no consequence to her life. And she either feels so empowered or so frustrated that she doesn't see the connection. And, you know, that's a real problem for us, is that young people feel that elected officials in Congress and all that, you know, and all of that has absolutely no consequence for good or bad in their lives. So that's why it's so challenging. And, you know, we tried in Ohio this year, you know, there are new technologies coming out all the time, text messaging people. You know, I could stand up at this event and I could tell everybody to hold up their cell phone and punch in a phone number, and your cell phone would automatically get logged into a database that we hold, where then anytime I wanted to text message anybody in this room, you know, thousands of people with a message, I could do that. That's the kind of thing that we have to do more of with young people because they're so mobile.
Referring back to the example you gave about addressing the hospital staff, how they interact with people, what are your thoughts or agencies having consideration about how that affects other groups that are discriminated against or have the same kind of Hispanic couple or immigrants who speak English having the same kind of fears going to the hospital?
Well, there's a There's a slightly different challenge. Well, not for immigrants, but there's the slight challenge, or the challenge we have that is different in the hospital project as opposed to the corporate project, is that if you are that admitting person in Kansas, and if that woman sits down at your desk with that little girl, who we all think of as her daughter, and the hospital admitting person, you know, and she has to stitch up her head, and then, oh my gosh, we've got something happened, and we have to have a special procedure, and the parent has to sign off on it, and the other mommy is on a plane somewhere. Technically speaking, you know, the hospital admitting person is saying, the bottom line here is we have to follow the law, and we're following the law when we acknowledge that, you know, you two people have no relationship to one another in Kansas, because different states, obviously, you know, if you live in a state where you can do a second parent adoption, obviously you would do that. So we're mindful of the fact that things like that make this work different, that in Washington, D.C., there really are two. So with regard to the immigrant community, I think to go into hospitals and say, okay, mindful of the law, you also can be sensitive to alternative families, to all sorts of different people, to a sensitivity about who's coming in the door. So what type of sensitivity training are you doing for all sorts of alternative cultures that might come in your door? You know, and we can have that conversation. And if we go with, say, something like the Tannenbaum Foundation or some of the other people out there who are doing this work, they're doing all sorts of the things that you're talking about. So I think our work, while it's going to be directed at our community, should do something to lift the sensitivity to all hospitals. But again, it's very sensitive. In Washington, D.C., for instance, there are two hospitals, big hospitals. There's George Washington University Hospital and Georgetown University Hospital. Well, anybody in Washington would tell you that George Washington University Hospital, whether it's their admitting forms or whether it's their policies, is better for the GLBT community. Georgetown is run by the Jesuits. Like, at some point, that has something to do with it. And so we have to work through that and figure out how to represent these hospitals and their positions and their views on our community in a fair way. And so we're working through it right now, and it's very complicated. But I think, with regard to your comment, that this work is going to raise their sensitivity to, you know, anybody who comes through the door. I think that the greatest lesson that I learned at Emily's List was that, well, maybe it's not the lesson, but what we did and it worked. Every day we said to pro-choice Democratic women who wanted to change the face of Congress that they were powerful, and that if they chose to harness that power and use it in a very effective way, they could make a difference. And, you know, over the course of the time I was there, we elected 63 pro-choice Democratic women just to the House of Representatives, because those women took their power and used it. The challenge in the GLBT community is that we are not, like the choice community, all sorts of different people drawn together by one ideology. We're all sorts of different people drawn together by our genetic makeup. And so our priorities are all over the map. So I go from New York City and a, you know, upper income white guy lawyer partner at a law firm who is sort of beyond marriage and hate crimes and workplace discrimination because it's not his experience, but wants to be married. And then I go to Birmingham and talk with a lesbian on the plant floor who thinks only about her workplace security and about not being able to be out and open in a job she's had for 34 years. So that's the spectrum, and that's what we, that's probably my biggest challenge every day, is to not just get everybody on the same road to equality, but to get everybody inspired by the work. You know, I'm going down back to New York, and we have our New York City gala Saturday night with 1,200 people. And, you know, I'm going to be talking a lot about that woman on the plant floor, because that is how we will become a much more powerful movement if we can all get on the same page. Now, the other thing that helps are examples of success. And I went around the country for a year and said, we're going to elect three senators. We're going to elect Amy Klobuchar, Sherrod Brown, and Bob Casey. Those are going to be our targets. You got to give money to them. You've got to canvass for them. You know, I mean, getting like those gay men in Cleveland to go out and canvass in the cold on a Saturday afternoon, that was like a repeated message I had to keep delivering. But what, because I myself am not a big canvasser, but what really worked is when Sherrod Brown got elected and Sherrod Brown stood up in the stage and said, organized labor and the GLBT community in Ohio are the reason I'm here. That was a far cry from the message you heard from people in Ohio after 2004 about our community. So winning really helps with my message.
I'm wondering what you're doing with or for or alongside institutions that don't have autonomy. So I'm from Michigan, and I'm thinking about the University of Michigan that just this week sent a really mournful, genuinely mournful email to their email list of students and faculty saying, because of this proposal that passed 2 years ago, after this academic year, we can no longer recognize partnerships that we have afforded insurance to, et cetera, for the past at least 10 years. And the city of Ann Arbor can no longer give domestic partnerships after 25 years of doing so. So for those institutions that can't control their own rating or behavior because of state law, I'm wondering what kind of work can be done within those constraints?
Well, unfortunately, you know, I mean, a state institution, the kind you're talking about, I mean, it's like state government, and it falls under the state law, and it's, I mean, it's the great crisis, I mean, the sort of on-the-surface crisis of these marriage bans in these states is obviously that they've enshrined discrimination into their constitutions, and that's going to be a long time coming out from under that, but the sort of second, where now you're seeing the secondary effect of that. And, you know, I think if you put that question into the broader context of what are we doing about trying to close that economic gap that exists for same-sex couples in this country, you know, I really go back to, I said this to someone the other day, you know, it's not that complicated. It's like math. And we just need to add more people to the United States Senate, the United States House, to the Michigan legislature to try and slowly but surely make that change. And, you know, legislatures in states around the country, that's not been a focus of the national movement nearly as much as it was in the last 2 years. And so, you know, that's what we've got to do. And at the federal level, this is a little bit of apples and oranges, but I'll give you an example some of you might have read about. We've also got to be creative about where we can institute some right or some benefit that's been taken away someplace else. So some of you may have read about the pension provisions that we were able to get into the Pension Protection Act. And I don't know if you're all familiar with this. How many people know about this? All right, this is about like money for us, so you have to pay attention to this. So the sweeping Pension Reform Act is being taken up last September, I think it was, and everybody knew the president was going to sign it. And so we worked with a bipartisan group of, you know, Olympia Snowe from Maine and Senator Kennedy from Massachusetts and a handful of others and said, you know, what can we get in to change the circumstance for our community with regard to pensions? And we got two provisions in. One says that you can leave your partner your 401k now if you die, tax-free, penalty-free. The other one says that you can draw on your 401k tax-free and penalty-free if your partner experiences some sort of medical emergency. Now, previously, those were provisions only available to married people. We slid them into there were 157 provisions in a 900-page bill, and we slid those two in. And, you know, as I like to say, and we hoped that the president would have read it before he signed it. But the fact of the matter is, the president actually doesn't read it before he signs it. And the reason is because when you're passing sweeping legislation like a pension provision, you know there's stuff in it attached that you're not going to like. And if you were to go and sort of rebut those 157 provisions, the whole thing would get shut down. So the White House signs it, and it goes through, and we were able to get that done. And we knew that was a clever way of doing it. Now, the IRS has just ruled that that corporations can decide whether they want to let you do that or not. But when I think about how far ahead corporate America is from America generally, I don't think that's going to be a problem. So I tell you that long example because I think electing more people to try to undo this stuff and then figuring out creative ways to close that economic gap that we're losing in situations like that are the best thing we can do.